The phone recording begins with a laugh, not the uncertain, fragmented sound of a man whose doctors filed 17 pages of testimony claiming advanced cognitive decline, not the halting confusion of someone diagnosed with dementia and late-onset Alzheimer's disease. The phone recording begins with a man laughing clearly, quickly, at a specific moment in a conversation. The kind of laugh that requires you to understand context, to register irony, to track a social situation in real time, the kind of laugh that a brain in the state his lawyers described cannot produce. The man on the recording is Michael Scott Jeffries, 79 years old, former CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch, calling from a federal detention facility. The date is sometime in early 2026. His legal team has spent months building a case that he is unfit to stand trial. The government has spent those same months collecting recordings. Prosecutors have now filed a motion stating that the recordings directly contradict the cognitive impairment narrative offered by the defense. The court will decide whether Jeffries is competent to stand trial on charges that include sex trafficking, commercial sex acts, and multiple counts related to the recruitment and exploitation of male models over a span of years. The trial date has been delayed multiple times. The recordings suggest it cannot be delayed much longer. To understand how a 79-year-old former retail CEO came to be making laughing phone calls from a federal detention facility, you have to go back to a specific ideology, one that Jeffries spent 30 years building into one of the most recognizable brands in American commerce, and that he apparently never stopped living by. Mike Jeffries became CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch in 1992. The company he inherited was a struggling outdoor sporting goods retailer, founded in 1902, that had filed for bankruptcy in 1977 and spent the following decade trying to find an identity. What Jeffries gave it was something considerably more specific and considerably more dangerous than an identity. He gave it a theology. Under Jeffries, Abercrombie & Fitch became a company built on the explicit premise that some people's bodies were worth looking at and others were not. The look policy, never officially written but consistently enforced, governed every hiring decision. Store associates, called models, were required to meet specific physical standards. Uniforms were calibrated to display muscle definition. Marketing was built around shirtless images of young people with symmetrical faces and low body fat percentages. Jeffries said in a now infamous 2006 interview that he only wanted attractive people shopping in his stores, that Abercrombie was for the cool kids, and that it was exclusionary by design. The interview caused public outrage. Jeffries eventually apologized. The company's stock eventually recovered. Jeffries kept running the company until 2014. What the public didn't know, what investigators would spend years assembling, was that the physical perfection ideology running through the brand's marketing wasn't separate from Jeffries' personal behavior. It was the same impulse. It was the same theology. The store was, in a specific and documented sense, a pipeline. The indictment unsealed in late 2023 charged Jeffries, his long-term partner Matthew Smith, and a third individual, a recruiter operating primarily in Europe, with multiple counts, including sex trafficking, conspiracy to commit sex trafficking, and interstate transportation for sexual activity. The core allegation was this. Over a period of years, young men were recruited into a private event circuit under the pretense of modeling or brand ambassador opportunities. They were flown to locations including Jeffries' private residences. They were given explicit instructions about what the events would involve before arrival. Those who agreed received payment. Those who did not agree were not given what they had been promised. Prosecutors alleged the operation was systematic. It had a logistics infrastructure. There was recruitment, screening, transportation, accommodation, payment processing. There were people who managed the calendar, booked the flights, handled the non-disclosure agreements. There was a specific pattern to how the promises were made and how the payments were structured to maintain leverage after the events occurred. This was not improvised. This was managed. The mystery, as prosecutors began working through the evidence, was not whether the operation existed. The documentation was substantial. The mystery was how long the people closest to Jeffries had known. and what role proximity to his resources had played in keeping them quiet, court filings have referenced a long-serving personal assistant, referred to in documents only as Individual A, whose role appeared to span both legitimate professional duties and specific logistical tasks related to the private events. Individual A's testimony, if provided, would be among the most significant in the case. That testimony has not yet been given. The trial has not yet begun. Individual A's name has not been made public. Whether they cooperate with prosecutors, whether they have already cooperated, under seal, remains one of the central open questions of the case. Jeffries was arrested in the autumn of 2023. He posted bail and returned to his home in Southampton, New York. He hired a legal team, whose initial strategy appeared to be delay. Medical evaluations were commissioned. Experts were retained. In the spring of 2024, defense attorneys filed the first competency challenge, arguing that Jeffrey's cognitive state had declined to a degree that rendered him unable to meaningfully assist in his own defense. Competency challenges are not unusual in complex federal cases involving elderly defendants. They are also not unusual as tactical instruments. The legal threshold for incompetency to stand trial, derived from the 1960 Supreme Court standard in Dusky v. United States, requires that a defendant have a rational and factual understanding of the proceedings and be able to consult with counsel with a reasonable degree of understanding. Jeffrey's legal team argued he did not meet that threshold. Prosecutors argued the opposite. You are inside the detention facility now, not Jeffrey's former Southampton compound with its 45-foot boat and the art collection and the staff who knew better than to ask direct questions. This is the federal facility where he was detained after a bail modification. The fluorescent lights hum at a specific frequency. The phone on the wall costs money per minute. Every call is recorded. He doesn't always seem to remember this. The recordings prosecutors now possess cover multiple calls over multiple months. Legal observers with access to the filings describe a defendant who discusses his case with clarity, references specific legal documents by their proper names, and engages in what appear to be strategic calculations about his legal position. None of this is how a person in an advanced stage of dementia communicates. None of this is consistent with the clinical picture the defense team presented to the court. The defense has responded by arguing that Jeffries has good days and bad days, that the recordings represent his better periods, that a determination of competency cannot be made on the basis of selected call excerpts. The court has not yet ruled. There is something specifically disturbing about the architecture of this case that goes beyond the charges themselves, disturbing as those are. The architecture is this. For 30 years, Mike Jeffries ran a public-facing operation built on the commercial evaluation of human bodies. He decided, publicly and explicitly, which bodies were worth presenting and which were not. He built that judgment into hiring policy, into store design, into marketing, into the product itself. He made that ideology the company's competitive advantage. And then, in private, he allegedly used the same evaluative framework, the same belief that access to his resources entitled him to possess certain bodies, to run a trafficking operation. The brand was never separate from the behavior. The brand was the behavior, expressed in a form that got a corporate license. That is the thing the phone recordings, and the competency hearings, and the court filings, and the parade of legal delays cannot obscure. It was always there in the 2006 interview. It was there in the shirtless posters and the hired body associates and the store policies that rewarded symmetry and punished everything else. The private events were not an aberration from the brand. They were its logical extension, operated without the public-facing layer. Individual A, whoever they are, wherever they are now, whatever they said or will say to prosecutors, worked inside that system. So did dozens of other people. Some filed lawsuits. Some signed non-disclosure agreements. Some kept the calendar and booked the flights, and did not ask the question that the phone recordings now force everyone to ask. The question is not whether Michael Jeffries can stand trial. The recordings suggest he can. The question is whether a trial, when it finally occurs, will examine not just what Jeffries allegedly did in private, but the institutional system that made it possible for 30 years for a man running a company on the explicit premise that bodies were assets to be evaluated and deployed to move product, to do so without anyone powerful enough to stop him ever finding it necessary to try. Whether the jury will be asked to evaluate that question, or whether they will be asked only to evaluate the specific counts in the indictment, may determine what justice actually looks like when the verdict finally comes. Was the Abercrombie brand the cover story? Or was the cover story always the brand?